And I'm going to call this meeting to order. Winter, will you please take a roll call?
Chair Downs?
Here.
Vice Chair Arascada?
There.
Regent Carvalho?
Here.
Regent Goodman?
Here.
Regent McGrath?
Here.
You do have a quorum present.
Thank you. And next, we move to Pledge of Allegiance. Please stand and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance, if you can.
To the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Agenda item number one, public comments. For those who would like to call in and offer public comment, please dial 669-444-9171 and enter meeting ID 933-5568-7402 and passcode 555-555. Is there any public comment at GBC?
There is none at this time.
Thank you. Is there any public comment at the system office in Las Vegas?
No public comment, thank you.
Thank you. Is there any public comment here in Reno? Seeing none. SCS, is there any public comment on the phone?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll move on to agenda item number two, minutes. The committee will consider approval of the minutes from the March 20th, 2025 meeting.
Motion to approve.
We have a motion to approve. Is there a second?
Second from Regent McGrath.
So we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Abstentions? I say aye as well. Motion passes. Okay, on to item number three, Chair's Report. I don't have a long report. I would say that this has been interesting getting involved with this committee. And Vice Chair and I have had a chance to meet with the Cambridge Associates, Wendy and EJ. Saying it right? Okay. And they've been very helpful, very patient with us, and looking forward to their presentation today. So we'll move on then. I just got a note about something. I'm not sure what that was. Okay. We'll move on to item number four, the outsourced chief investment officer services. This is a possible action item. Chris Vadone, CFO.
Thank you, Chair Downs, members of the committee. Item four on your agenda is a request for your approval of the award of the outsourced chief investment officer solicitation to Cambridge Associates. Just wanted to give you a little background on the solicitation. The system began a relationship with outsourced chief investment officer approach in 2016. Back at that time, the relationship was initially, we initially split the endowment between two managers, Cambridge being one. In 2021, the fund was consolidated under Cambridge's management as a single outsourced chief investment officer. That relationship, this contract, current term was expiring December 31st, 25, and so we undertook a competitive public solicitation for this relationship over the summer. We had a RFP review committee that had membership representing from UNR, UNLV, DRI, CSN and system administration. That committee reviewed the responses provided from six respondents. And following the committee's review, they narrowed that to two finalists that were interviewed at the end of August by the committee. The committee result was a unanimous recommendation to make the award to Cambridge Associates, both on their qualifications and on competitive fee structure. And they have a presentation for you if you'd like to hear that.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, Wendy Walker of Cambridge Associates. It's a delight to be here with you today to discuss extending our partnership. And I believe that everyone on the investment committee has previously met EJ Ogbeche and myself here in Reno as an NSHE's investment team. But before we dive into this agenda item, I wanted to give our colleague Rob Rogers from our leadership team in Boston the opportunity to introduce himself. Do we have him on camera?
Yep, I'm right here. To the chair, to the regents, and everybody, thank you so much for welcoming me here and for your very collaborative work with our team. I'm Rob Rogers. I'm the head of client solutions for our endowment and foundation clients at Cambridge Associates. And my role in this situation is to ensure through the process that we are bringing the right services, the right resources, and at the right fee for the system. Both today and in the future. So you should expect to see me checking back in occasionally to make sure that that continues to be the case. And I'm open to any and all feedback, constructive or positive. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. So diving into our materials for this discussion, why don't we start on slide 4 of 30. And I'll be very brief here because I don't want to steal EJ's thunder since he'll be presenting the endowment performance update later in the meeting. But just as a teaser, I'd say that we are very proud of the outperformance we have delivered on behalf of the NSHE campuses, faculties, and students. So moving forward to slide 5 of 30, zooming out, we always aim to ground our investment services in each client's unique operating circumstances, financial profile, and needs. And when we look at slide 5, we can see here it says $357 million, which is actually a little dated. Today, as of yesterday's close, we're closer to $371 million of endowment dollars supporting 8 campuses with materially different dependence on this pool of assets. I've attended meetings over the years at campuses all over the states and state, and I think it's fair to say that the operating operating circumstances at Great Bays and College, for example, are different from that of UNR and UNLV. So we're always aiming to optimize this portfolio for all 8 campuses. Maybe just taking a step back as background, I've been serving NSHE for about 14 years now, and this next item about your circumstances that I want to be honest about, and it's not judgment, but it's just a fact that over the 14 years that I've served NSHE, I've worked with 4 CFOs and 9 investment committee chairs. And this is significantly higher turnover than what we see for most institutions that I serve. But through that, NSHE's endowment portfolio has been in the top quartile of similarly sized peers over the most recent trailing 5-year period for which we have full portfolio returns, including privates. We've added 98 basis points of value add. And in prior periods, say during the market sell-off of 2022, our value add was significantly higher than that. So again, really pleased and proud of the results that we've been able to deliver for NSHE and the campuses. On the right-hand side of this slide, though, we lay out some concerns that we want to be mindful of, and we're always aiming to address the next challenges that the markets will give us, because we know they will give us challenges. I'd highlight a few. So state appropriations, number one, they're volatile. I saw this coming out when I first started working with you. It was coming out of the global financial crisis, and appropriations were down. We've seen how they can move in different economic environments. And when state appropriations go down, it can put new pressures on the campuses, which makes the stakes even higher for our endowment and our operating pool to fund the programs that rely on the payout. And then, you know, this fact of the turnover, it raises concerns that historical facts, you know, if there's continued turnover, it's hard for newer members of leadership to necessarily stick with the long-term strategy. CFO Vitan mentioned this Russell, the decision back in 2016 to split the mandate, and that ended up being a very costly decision for ENGIE. And, you know, we want to be cognizant of the natural the natural tendency of folks to want to do something new and not necessarily have the institutional memory of why historical decisions have been made, and we want to make sure that we have consistency and ability to address that risk. And then the bottom right risk, I think, is the biggest concern, and this is a concern on behalf of all of our clients, is that we don't think that the market's going to provide what it has delivered over the past 10 years of being invested in just stocks and bonds. There's been enormous tailwinds over the past couple of decades that we don't think we'll benefit from looking ahead. And so this means that we'll need to rely even more on private investments to deliver this and other alternative assets. So, you know, taking a step back then, the question I'd like to use to frame our work together over the next contract is, what do we have to do to maintain and extend the strong performance that we've enjoyed recently? And I'm going to propose two things. And if we move to the next slide, please. One is that we want to maintain the strong and stable partnership that we've had for many years. If our team, EJ, myself, colleagues who work in the background to support this portfolio, if we can be a source of strength and stability, if you have access to a deep bench behind the two of us, we have diverse expertise, we have long-term succession plans. EJ's a lot younger than I am. If we continue to deliver all these elements on the left side of the page, then that will increase the probability of success for ENGIE's portfolio. And then the second thing, it's summarized on the right-hand side of the page. We're optimizing this portfolio for the system, and each portfolio is optimized to meet its unique role in the system's finances. So for the endowment, it's the highest reasonable allocation to growth assets. It's and so that we can maximize long-term growth. And then high conviction private investments. This is really, truly the driver of long-term outperformance for ENGIE and our other clients. And then the final element would be diversification in the portfolio. So assets that don't necessarily rely on capital markets returns to deliver performance. And what this does is two things. It provides a liquid source of spending for when equities are under pressure. And they are, we know that they will be under pressure from time to time over the next decade. And as a result of this, this more stable source of spending support, we hope that it will give ENGIE leadership confidence today and in the future to maintain this posture of leaning into growth assets. So this is kind of the big picture of what we talked in a lot of detail about with the search committee. And given that we have much more limited agenda time with this group today, I'd love to welcome direction from committee members on, you know, which elements of this you might want to do a deeper dive on. You know, would you like to hear about our stakeholder education and engagement, our asset allocation, or private investments? Are any of these topics of top of mind for you folks to understand a little better?
Does anyone have any ideas they want to seek from Cambridge Associates?
Chair Downs, this is Regent.
Yes.
Carvalho. I'd like to hear about the private markets that Ms. Walker mentioned. I'm curious to know what that consists of and what she suggests for us.
Great, great. And to be clear, what we're suggesting is a continuation of the strategy we've had in place for quite a few years, and privates have been the primary driver of long-term results. And the stakes today, like I said, are high with public equities and fixed income, you know, not likely to support as high a spending rate. So maybe I'll turn it over to EJ if you want to talk about private investments in the portfolio.
Thank you, EJ Ogbeche, for the record, Cambridge Associates. So I can move to slide 12 of 30 to begin. To answer your question, you know, what do we have in mind for privates? As Wendy mentioned, it's really to lean into areas of strength in the portfolio. And we're trying to build a portfolio that has the highest possible growth allocation. And you see that here in terms of growth in our high conviction private investments. And you'll see on the chart to the left, these private investment asset classes like private growth, private real assets, we expect to see 300 to 500 basis points of outperformance in those asset classes over a full market cycle, which you can also see is far greater than what we would expect for any public market asset allocation. So again, just to answer your question, really leaning into the private investments and to understand why, we can move to the next slide. This is where we've seen, you know, again, tremendous performance in the portfolio. And I'll touch on this again in the endowment section, but, you know, just looking at the past almost 5 years, what you can see from years in 2020 and 2021, I had to just double check that these aren't typos, almost 25% outperformance in 2020 and over 100% outperformance in 2021, 108.4% to be exact. And then even in a down year like 2022, where public markets were challenged, that private investment portfolio maintained that outperformance and still not only drove outperformance but protected capital on the downside. And so that leaves us less concerned about markets like we saw in 2023 and 2024, where the private investments are lagging the public benchmark, because we have this broader aperture where we're looking at how are private investments contributing to the portfolio over the long term. And we can see even with these 2 years of underperformance, the greater context shows that private investments have added value over time. And that's what we expect in this allocation going forward. Again, our expectation is 300 to 500 basis points. And I think what you've experienced here has been far greater than that. And I'll get into that detail in a moment. And I guess the last thing I'd quickly say, or the last couple things I'd say on the next slide to respond to this question, again, why leaning into private investments on slide 12 of slide 14 of 30, excuse me, the next slide. On the left-hand side, you'll see the public equity or the marketable strategies, and you'll see the different quartiles there, and you'll notice the much tighter divergence across the performance. So you could expect, you know, if, for example, in U.S. large cap, if you were in the fourth quartile of that performance, that wouldn't be as challenging of an environment as if you were in the fourth quartile in your venture allocation, where you could be negative. And so, you know, you really are punished for mistakes. But that's why we lean into the research team that we have. And I'll finish on the next slide briefly, that really what's behind this portfolio and behind this team that you see here today is really a process and a system that really helps support us. And that's not just from the 5 decades of history that we have. It's not the depth across the different continents and asset classes and strategies and different meetings that we have with managers every year, but it's the selectiveness across that process that ends up yielding that helps us focus on the top quartiles of performance in those private asset classes that we mentioned. I'll pause there, but hopefully answered your question.
Are there any questions from the committee?
And Chair Downs, for the record, this is your special counsel, Chris Nielsen. Just a reminder, we are still on agenda item 4, which is for possible action. And so at some point, I would encourage you to entertain a motion, something along the lines of to accept the recommendation of the RFP Evaluation Committee to approve the award for OCIO services for the endowment to fund Cambridge Associates and authorize the chancellor to execute the services agreement.
Respectfully, Special Counsel Nielsen, I'd like to hear the rest of the presentation, what we have in front of us.
Absolutely. I just wanted to just a reminder, this is, I just reminded the committee this is an action item.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, honestly, we didn't necessarily intend to march through all of these slides, just given timing needs. But if there are areas, I do appreciate the interest in private investments because they are a little more esoteric. If there are other areas of the partnership that we've delivered or the team and our resources, happy to address those.
A question from the Vice Chair, Garscotta.
And we were so close to that slide. The next slide down, 18. Slide 16, but 18 on the paper, if we could go down to that slide.
Sure.
One more, two more down. And there we go. So what we're looking at right here on this is the investment during this on page 18 is what we have in front of us. The added value for the UNR and UNLV campuses, it's clearly evident. And what you all, Cambridge Associates, have succeeded to do is provide great results. But one of the items I've voiced with great admiration are the investment capabilities and powers, but the differences between the two campuses. And I say with great admiration because the University of Nevada, Las Vegas Foundation has clearly benefited more than the UNR, than the University of Nevada Foundation. And I ask this because although the footnote identifies that very, I think you have a font 6 or 4 on that, on some of those footnotes, but I ask this because it identifies the returns are presented gross of fees paid to Cambridge to ensure the comparability with the UNR, UNLV returns provided by the provided by INCHI to Cambridge. So, and I see that we have individuals from the University of Nevada Foundation here today. So why the disparity? Why the difference? I mean, because even if you look at fiscal year 2025, fiscal year 2022-23, and even 2021, there's been great rewards, reap the rewards from, and I say this with great admiration, as I've presented, UNLV Foundation has done really well. And I'm eyeballing you over there, Mr. Densler. But please, Wendy.
You know, it's hard for us to comment on the returns for each institution. I would flag as part of the data collection that we do in these comparative analyses, we also look at the spending rates from these different pools. And I would wager that both these other portfolios have been through the years optimized to meet the needs of those specific institutions and that and their payout rules. And I'm sure Mr. Densler can speak to that on behalf of UNR. I think when we look at our long-term performance, so the trailing 8 years, which is our full OCIO track record today, I think privates have been the largest source of that outperformance, and EJ's commentary showed how that really came through back in 2020 and 2021. You know, the fact that we're outperforming over the, you know, 8 years in the context of a perpetual institution, 8 years is a short amount of time. And I can guarantee that we will not be top quartile in every time period looking ahead. So I want to be upfront and prepare for that. But I do think that the consistency of returns the magnitude of outperformance has been driven in part by the consistency of the investment strategy here for ENGIE.
Okay. If we could hear from both the University of Nevada, Reno and the University of Nevada, Las Vegas Foundation representatives. I'd really appreciate it. Mr. Densler, if you could just give me a little background.
I'm sorry, we can't hear you down here.
Let's try that. Is that working? Are you hearing me now?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay, sorry. So Mark Densler from UNR Foundation for the record. I'm currently serving as the CIO on a contract basis with UNR Foundation, previously having sat on the investment committee for 10 years, and part of that period of time was as investment chair. And the short answer, Regent Arascata, is ENCHI has done a better job of executing than UNR. So let me walk it back just a little bit. When I joined the investment committee, we had a consultant that was a very good quality, high, you know, national consultant, but it's a consultant that had its roots in ERISA-type plans. So it was very risk averse. It was definitely focused on a pension sort of lookout of what they needed to do to match the returns. We became disenchanted and realized that we were not properly balancing the portfolio in terms of the risk reward. And about 3 years ago, we took the steps, went through an RFP process that ultimately awarded a advisory role to Cambridge, a different team than Wendy's, but also out of the San Francisco office. At the same time, we started making very definite changes in the portfolio, recognizing that we needed to move away from just being median returns to move up the process. I'm going to actually use their chart on page 12 because I think it really explains it. And also, I would be happy to defend the numbers on an absolute basis at 10.3 is not a bad return at all on an absolute basis, but on a relative basis, I understand. On the right-hand side, you talk about the sort of passive returns building up with the strategic asset allocation, getting to about an 8.4%. I think UNR, all the foundations were doing a really good job on it. The difference was in that targeted value added from active management. That is the differential where it's coming from. Where do you get the extra alpha? And that's where you at ENCHI, by having an OCIO with Cambridge, do a better job of executing than we did. And we recognize that. So we made those changes. We started spending a little bit more risk on a very conscious basis. We still got to protect to the downside. And by making the changes to a new investment consultant, by actually having me come in and dedicate pretty much full time to doing a similar role to they are, but still the investment committee is the ultimate decision maker. Also, the other issue that you have by still having a governance with the investment committee, historically, there were some bad choices made in investments. I'll give you one of them. Wendy and EJ can potentially, raise their eyebrows on that. We used to have some of the Hard Rock Miner guys on our investment committee. They were big into commodities. We are just now getting rid of our allocation to commodities. Commodities over the trailing 5 years have yielded 2%. That has been a drag on this portfolio. There were also some people that very definitely believed in real estate. Real estate has not been accretive to the portfolio. So when you look at the composition of the two portfolios, that explains it. So what I'm going to offer as evidence that we're actually making progress is if you compare the 630 information that EJ is going to talk about later, the one-year trailing rate, I believe, on NGEJ, you're 10.3. We're actually 10.7. So on the year, we are now ahead of ENCHI. And on the five-year, we've closed almost a 200 basis gap to 100 basis point. You're at 10.9, and we're at 9.9. So progress is being made because we're focused on that value added. How do you grind out that extra 1 to 2% by just executing better? So a bit of a long answer, but hopefully that addresses it.
It definitely addressed it. And from what I'm hearing, and help me if I'm translating this correctly, the University of Nevada has been in first gear to use an automotive metaphor, mm-hmm. and you're skipping second, you're going right to third gear. Are you going to be investing more aggressively, or is the campus going to be investing more aggressively than in the past?
No, I agree with your analogy from first to third gear. We're going to be doing a better job of investing. So instead of picking a manager that is only going to give us first or second gear sort of performance, the same allocation that we had before, we're picking a better manager that actually should give us that third gear type of performance. And where we can't find that, we just go back to the passive market. So the intent here is actually to take on better performance without taking on a whole lot more risk. So it's a balanced approach.
Can you restate the relinquishment of the commodities and the real estate? What's going on there? So we're not, the University of Nevada is not going to be investing into those?
That's correct. So commodities in the broader market cycle, and Cambridge puts out regular papers on these things, as do all the investment consultants. The commodities were a very strong performing asset class when China was building out its infrastructure, for instance. They were sucking up commodities all over the world. We're moving from a building world to a service world. The level of commodities, specialized commodities, obviously lithium, things that we all hear about, mm-hmm. gold prices. But in general, broadly, commodities are not a performing asset class and not expected to be for the foreseeable future. So we should have been out of it probably at least 5 years ago. We held on to it too long. So by holding on to it long, it's underperformed. It's been a drag on the portfolio. Similarly, real estate has been the same way. Is the entire real estate market has been a good anchor for ERISA-type portfolios that want a very guaranteed return. But when you're trying to get the returns that we're talking about here, and real estate is only yielding you a 4 to 5% sort of return, it again is a drag on the portfolio. In our case, we can't shed the real estate portfolio because those are tied up in long-term alternatives. We just have to ride that out and that not be allocating anything more to that asset class. So we're trying to just execute smarter, not differently. What we've been doing all along has been the right idea. We just haven't had the right consultant and the right mix of people to help us actually execute better.
Thank you, Mr. Denzer. Appreciate it. Thank you, Chair.
You're welcome, Vice Chair Arascotta. The representative from UNLV is not in attendance today, so you cannot get a report there.
Okay, that's unfortunate. All right, thank you.
Do we have any other questions for the representatives from Cambridge Associates? Seeing none, is there a motion to...
I'm sorry, Chair,
yes.
Downs. This is Regent Carvalho again. I am just curious to know if there is a fiscal impact note, regarding the fees. And I'm just wondering if those are similar or the same that we've had in the past, or is there, what does that look like comparatively speaking to our previous engagement with Cambridge?
Wendy Walker, for the record, that's the exact same fee schedule as under our prior engagements since 2016.
Thank you very much. And I'll go ahead and make that motion to approve this new service with Cambridge.
Second.
So we have a motion and a second to approve the Cambridge Associates as the outsourced chief investment officer. Let me see if I read this correctly. To approve the award for the OCIO services for the endowment fund to Cambridge Associates and authorize the chancellor to execute services agreements. And is there any more discussion about this? Seeing none, I'll call for the vote. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, signify by saying nay. No abstentions. Motion passes. Okay, thank you. So now we're going to move on to agenda item number 5, the operating pool performance discussion and recommendations. This is another possible action item. And so, again, Ms. Walker and Mr. I'm going to do my best here. Is it?
Ogbeche.
Ogbeche.
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks so much. So in the materials for Section 5, I might suggest starting off on page 12 to give a few brief market comments before we offer our rebalancing recommendations. The data shown here on page 12 are as of August 31st. Even at that point, we had seen a very strong market, really a turnaround from when we met with you folks back in March, where most U.S. equities were negative for the year to date. What we've seen is a real rebound, a lot of volatility in April, and then just very strong momentum since then. And then so to update some of these numbers on the page, upper right, global equities as of yesterday's market close are now up 17.9%. Within that, the U.S. is up 14%, and developed international regions, so that's Europe, Japan, a couple of other developed markets, that's up over 24% for the calendar year to date. And EM is now up 26.9%, led by a very strong rally in China. Fixed income has also seen strong returns year to date with the Barclays Ag, which is the U.S. benchmark for fixed income. That's up 6.2% year to date. So, you know, it's just been a great period for risk assets across the board, despite all of the headlines that we all see every day around tariffs. There's and global macroeconomic and geopolitical uncertainty. We've seen inflation data come in lower than had been expected, even just last week with the most recent inflation numbers. Lower than fears. We haven't really seen the tariff prices flowing through to consumer prices quite yet. There's some weakness in the labor market coming out, which is what helped encourage the Fed to reduce interest rates recently. But right now the market is seemingly pricing in a very rosy future. Despite a looming government shutdown and other challenges that are front and center for many of us. We have a few slides on tariffs. I don't know, just in the interest of time, that we'll go into a lot of detail since these tend to change on a day-by-day basis. But I might suggest jumping ahead to slide 16, which is most pertinent for our rebalancing recommendation that we'll offer shortly. So we're about to recommend that in the operating fund that we implement a tactical underweight to U.S. equities, offset by an overweight to developed market ex-U.S. equities. We've already implemented this stance in the endowment portfolio some time ago, where we have discretion to make changes on our own. And the context here is that we've seen in the relative performance that we saw year to date, international developed markets 10 percentage points ahead of U.S. markets. That's almost entirely driven by the depreciation in the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar has declined about 10% year to date. So what we're seeing is that, and arguably the U.S. dollar, we've been saying for years that the U.S. dollar was quite overvalued relative to its own historical valuations, relative valuations to other global currencies. And the current federal administration has taken a number of steps, and they've been fairly explicit about wanting a weaker dollar to improve trade balances and improve, the standing of U.S. exporters. So when we look at this chart, we can see, very long-term trends on the left-hand side of the page that, these are international flows into U.S. dollars. So the U.S., it runs a large current account deficit, so we import more than we export, and that by definition, needs to be financed by a capital account surplus. More foreign assets or foreign buyers are coming in to purchase dollars. And so this surplus, for many, many years, we've started to see turnaround. There was a little bit of a shock back in April, right after the tariffs were announced. And we saw foreign buyers, you know, start to step away from U.S. Denominated assets, and some treasury auctions came in weaker than expected. And, you know, in our capital market team's view, this looks to be and has been telegraphed by the current federal administration as their intention to be just the beginning of a longer cycle of U.S. dollar weakness relative to peers relative to other global currencies. And so the risks that we see, we've seen geopolitical realignment. So not just the tariffs announced, but geopolitical alignment. Earlier this year, Europe made announcements about the U.S. being a less steadfast partner in geopolitical issues. There's the risk of erosion in U.S. institutions. There's concerns about just political involvement with the Fed. And so the dollar is going to be the balancing factor in a lot of these situations. And so the U.S. dollar weakness, we think, will play out into more robust returns coming from ex-U.S. Assets, in part because we as dollar-based investors will get more money than what local currency investors will get from those investments in their own local currencies. And then the second pillar, besides the U.S. dollar weakness, the second pillar to our recommendation for a tactical underweight to U.S. equities is, if we jump two slides ahead to page 18, we can see on the left-hand side of the page that relative to the U.S., developed market stocks, which are the dark blue line, and emerging market stocks, which are the light blue line, they're trading near historically large discounts. They're in the bottom decile of historical relative valuations. These are for the equities. And to put this into context, right now the forward price to earnings multiple on the MSCI US index is 22.8 times earnings, and for the developed market MSCI World ex US, it's only at 15.3 times earnings. So just much more favorable, much more rationally priced assets outside the US. So this would be the second pillar of our recommendation, or of the rationale for our recommendation for a tactical underweight to U.S. equities and, overweight to U.S., to ex-U.S. equities. And to put that into some specific numbers, if we could, go back to, page 7 of these materials, we're recommending a $23 million trim from Vanguard Institutional Index. That's our U.S. equity manager. A $9 million add to the Vanguard Developed Markets Index. So we're taking some off the top of U.S., adding some of that to developed markets, and then adding another chunk of that down to our Vanguard short-term inflation-protected securities. And the end result of that is shown on the subsequent slide, page 8. Which shows on the upper right, at the time we drafted and sent out these recommendations, we would have ended up just over 2 percentage points underweight to U.S. equities, the 37.8% versus 40. Based on market movements since then, we're actually a little bit closer to our policy targets, just because markets have continued to rally over the past month. And then adding $9 million to the Vanguard Developed Markets Index, which gets us about it's now slightly less than 2 percentage points overweight to our global ex-US equity target. And then down below, adding to tips, the short-term tips in particular, that gives us a slight, modest tactical overweight to tips. And as a result, we'll end up with a modest tactical underweight to nominal bonds. So I will pause there for any questions on this recommendation or the rationale that I've shared.
Are there any questions from the committee? Vice Chair Escada.
Thank you, Chair Downs.
Wendy, if you could please go back to the tips that you were just referring to in the middle of that page 8. Expand on that a little bit more. Provide me a little bit more clarity, please.
Sure. So tips are inflation-protected securities. So they're government bonds, similar to what we have in our long-term bond portfolio. But they pay part of the yield that they pay depends upon the prevalent inflation rate. I just looked this up before this morning's meeting. Right now, the break-even rate implied by the 5-year TIPS index implies that what is being priced into that pricing or to the yield that TIPS are being sold at, the break-even inflation is 2.4%. So that's what is inferred between the difference between these TIPS prices and nominal bond or treasury pricing, nominal treasury pricing. We think there is a risk that inflation might persist a little higher than this 2.4% break-even rate that's implied by that. So, going slightly overweight, we're talking less than a percentage point overweight into short-term tips, gives us some sort of optionality in terms of we get fixed income returns, but we also could benefit from an upside boost if inflation comes in higher than expected, than what's implied in that 2.4% break-even rate.
I'm following you on your chart right now.
On which chart, sorry?
On the page 8 that we have in front of us.
Yeah, exactly. So it would be a $14 million addition there, which would bring us to a 13.8% allocation to short-term tips. Does that address the question?
It does. It does. I just thank you for the clarity, actually.
Okay, sure.
Thank you very much.
Happy to.
Thank you, Ms. Walker.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Are there any other questions from other regents attending? I'd like to get some feedback, if no one else has questions. Feedback from Mr. Densler. Did you have any questions or comments about this?
I would just say that this is directionally similar to what UNR is looking at this point in time. The Regent Arizcata, I mean, the bottom line is tips are beneficial if you think inflation's coming in higher than what they're implied, and you don't want to be in them if you think that they're successfully going to drive inflation down to the 2% level. I think all of us rationally believe that things are going to be higher for longer, and therefore it'll pay you a benefit.
So if there are no other questions, this is a possible action item. Is there a motion? I'll entertain a motion if there's one to accept this this strategy change.
Chair Downs, I have one question.
Sure. Yes, please go forward.
So, listen, I am not an expert in this by any means, and this I don't even know if this is the right question. I just do this on my own. But is there any way we can see, just for our own just knowledge, any of the just the specific stocks that are in some of these different funds? I don't know if that's an option for us to be able to just see kind of the breakdown of what, you know, just so we have a better idea. I'm not questioning anything. I just would love to be able to see that breakdown. And I don't need to see it right now. I'm just saying for the future, I'd love to see a little bit more detail.
Sure. So happily, everything in the operating fund is is public knowledge. These are all publicly traded index funds, which implies that, so for example, the Vanguard Institutional Index, they just invest across the entire stock market. They're not stock picking. There's nothing proprietary about their approach. We can later share some of these stock tickers and links to the Vanguard website that shows you exactly what they are invested in. But you can think of it as they have a tiny sliver of every single company that is in the U.S. market. Similarly, with the Vanguard Developed Markets Index, same approach. Metis is another manager that we hired a few years ago for a little bit of diversification of the portfolio. Same exact approach. They're just passively tracking the entire index, so they're not stock pickers. The reason for this implementation in the operating fund is that this... Because the operating fund is basically the checkbook for all of the campuses, there's always been a premium placed on liquidity and stability of these assets. So the long-term assets, we do have some equity risk in there, but we have a lot of assets in the short-term and intermediate-term pools, which are meant to just support the system's ongoing and the campus's ongoing liquidity needs. But the operating fund is managed not as an attempt to deliver outperformance, but to simply have a very low-cost implementation, a very liquid implementation, and therefore the ambition is just to meet the benchmark returns rather than outperform the benchmark returns like we do in the endowment, where we have alternative assets and where there is more sensitivity around public disclosure of the active manager stock picking.
Thank you.
But for the operating
I appreciate
fund,
that detail.
No problem. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
So is there a motion I'm trying to look at the wording for this, to accept the recommendation presented by Cambridge Associates?
Yeah, I just add Special Counsel Nielsen as referenced on page 7, if that's what your intent is. Chair Downs.
Thank you.
Motion for approval.
Okay. Is there a second to the motion to accept this recommendation as found on page 7 of the executive summary of this presentation?
Second from Regent McGrath.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion on this item? Seeing none, I'll call for the vote. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. In opposition, signify by saying nay. Abstentions? Motion passes. Thank you. Okay.
Great. So... maybe I'll comment just one final comment if it's not too late on. I just wanted to touch on performance. Maybe I should have done this sooner, but performance for the operating fund on page 21 of INV5. Just wanted to flag that, you know, fiscal year performance for the fiscal year ended 6/30 was up 11%, just in line with the benchmark, just as we would have hoped. Calendar year-to-date performance was 7.4%, a tiny bit ahead of the benchmark. And I'd also share an update that it was up as of August 31st, it was up 12.4%, which is also in line with the benchmark. And then for the month of September through yesterday's close, up another 1.5%, so up 13.9% year-to-date is our estimate. So very, very strong returns calendar year to date. So I imagine we will be seeing some special distributions or some of the triggered distributions based on the size of that reserve account balance.
Okay. Thank you. So we'll move on then to item number 6, operating fund distribution rate, another action item. So we're going with
I can start it off. Yeah, thanks. Chair Downs, Chris Vitone for the record. Item six is a discussion for possible action. It's the committee's biennial opportunity to discuss and revisit the distribution rate on the operating fund. So the operating fund, as Ms. Walker mentioned, is the checkbook for the system. This is where all of the systems, all the campuses, institutions, operating funds are consolidated and invested at the system level. The policy was amended several years ago to automate distributions and automate halting distributions to better manage or better aiming to have a targeted limit to the reserve so that there isn't a unplanned or unscheduled growth in the assets as they outperform the market, as she mentioned. That distribution rate is set at 2.75%. As you just heard, the returns, as the returns exceed that rate, the reserve will grow. The policy has a trigger to automate the distribution of the reserve when the reserve exceeds 8% of the campus cash balance. And so the policy also has a trigger to halt distributions to prevent when the reserve balance may go negative or below 3%. So the goal of the policy is to provide some stability for the campuses in anticipating the regular monthly distributions, prevent a unexpected continual growth of the reserve balance by automating the distribution and putting those funds in the hands of the campuses to manage, but then also halting to prevent any unexpected erosion of the balance through underperformance. So that's been the policy that's been in place since 2021. In that time, both ends of the policy triggers have taken effect. The distributions, the regular monthly distributions, were halted in June of 22 for 10 of the next 12 months. But then when reinstated in June of 23, they've continued to date without interruption, and in that time there's been eight months where the 8% trigger was hit also and excess distributions were made to the campus. So that rate generally has functioned as expected when the business officers recommended that first in 21. And while it's here for your discussion today to take the punchline, I think the business officers are not recommending any change to it, and I know they want you to hear the thoughts and input from Cambridge as well.
Thank you.
Great. So looking at the slide we have in front of us, this gives our expectations over the very, very long run. Let's call it any 25-plus year period, what we expect this portfolio to deliver in returns. I'd point to the green dot, this 10-year average asset allocation. Folks may be aware the asset allocation of this portfolio varies quite a bit over the course of the year, depending on the timing of receipts of cash, either state appropriations or tuition payments. So the data on which, this is based in June, I think, was at when cash was relatively lower, so equities were higher. So that implied at that date that if that asset allocation stayed in place, this portfolio would have, would theoretically drive a 4.2% return over the very, very long term. Instead, I think this 3.8% potential return return assumption is more relevant because it kind of smooths out these periods of cash balances being higher versus lower. So 3.8%, you could say, will very safely cover this 2.75% payout through the years, and it's designed to do so. And there might be a question of why wouldn't we or the campus officers recommend increasing that monthly payout closer to that 3.8% expected return? If we move forward one slide, we can see that there's, you know, particularly over short-term periods, as we see on the far left-hand side of the page, three-year periods, there's a massive range of potential returns over the short term. So for every one of these time periods, the median expected return is 3.8% for every one of these time periods. Over the 25-year period, that range around 3.8 is fairly narrow, but over on the far left, a three-year period, and it would even be more so for shorter periods, you know, there's a very reasonable likelihood that you might have a negative return compounded over a three-year period. So there's, you know, we want to be mindful of not setting the distribution rate so high that the reserve account balance never grows to support spending in times of short-term market downturns. And moving ahead one slide, and this is related to some of my commentary from the OCIO finalist presentation, is that based on valuations in the current environment, we think that there are risks to this portfolio being able to, over the intermediate term, deliver that 3.8% that we would expect over the very long term. And I'll point out just a couple of asset classes that are quite large large components of the operating fund portfolio. So on the upper left, we have a call-out box for U.S. equities. And just to orient folks on the page, the striped bar chart suggests that over the long run, we expect that U.S. equities will deliver a 5.7% return on a real basis. This is net of inflation. So it would keep up with inflation and generate 5.7% return on top of inflation. Based on current valuations, and you heard me comment on how U.S. equities look very expensively valued relative to ex-U.S. equities, we have this sort of thought exercise. The solid bar suggests that in a hypothetical situation, if U.S. equities revert to their long-term historical averages, they will deliver a negative 2.5% real return. So on a nominal basis, you know, it might look more like a flat return, but if you strip out inflation, it would be negative. Similarly, on the far right side of the top half of the page, treasuries are also priced more expensive than history, where you know, over the long run, we would expect treasuries to deliver a 2.8% real return. If this hypothetical, you know, over a 10-year period, if valuations reverted to their long-term averages, treasuries would deliver only 1.5%. So looking ahead, based on today's valuations, we think that the operating fund will be less likely to support this 3.8% long-term returns. And you know, I want to caution that these are not our predictions. We do not we do not have confidence that we can predict the future and say that every asset class will go to its historical averages. In fact, I can almost guarantee that that won't exactly be the case across all asset classes. But directionally, it shows that current valuations and market dynamics will make it more difficult to support the 2.75% payout. And for that reason, we are supportive of maintaining the current practices where, you know, there are release valves on either end of that payout spectrum.
Thank you. We have any questions? Vice Chair Escada?
Thank you, Chair Downs.
One of the items in which you were very thoughtful about was wording, descriptions, projections. And on page 24 of one of the previous pages, it's Cambridge, and I give strong compliment, is while the 10-year average has a 3.8% expected real compound, and once again expected on the bottom left, over the given period of three-year period of time, the average has the likelihood, and over on the right-hand side, you have it has once again the likelihood and the potential. Very thoughtful, and what you just followed up on, which I was going to come at you with this, with those three items, and you stated that there has the there's a chance that it may be above and it may be below. I know it's a flip of a coin, but what side are you balancing on with this fence?
I think that's illustrated on the subsequent page that we would Correct. Expect it to come in below. And, you know, just doing this very naive math, and again, not our prediction, but on a naive math basis, we would expect this. The math suggests that the operating fund might return 1.5% real. So add, call it 2.5%, 2 to 3% inflation on top of that, instead of a 3.8% real return. So meaningfully lower. So we're cautious in this environment.
It's meaningful lower. Thank you.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Any questions from regents who are not on the committee but attending?
Chair Downs, Regent Goycalo for the record.
Yes, sir.
Oh, yes, thank you. I wasn't sure I came through or not. And I agree. I, you know, just sitting here listening, and we're looking at a declining dollar and someplace around even as high as 10%, it looks like. And, you know, we know we have positive inflation. So just as I'm no expert in this at all, I can tell you what a cow's worth, and that's about it. Other than that, but I do think it is time to be very cautious in these projections. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments from committee or regents off the committee?
Chair, this is boiling here.
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much, Chair. And I'm going to just preempt this by saying what Regent Goodman said. I really don't know much about this. I mess around with it, and I just try to impress, you know, my dogs and my sons. But I have a question, just, I may be offline here, but do we invest in anything that is just Nevada? I mean, we have oil in the north now, we're finding a whole bunch of rare earth minerals, that kind of stuff. Is there any company in Nevada that we just invest in? I mean, it's nice to invest in Timbuktu and everything else, but do we have anything from Nevada, ma'am? So, the two of you, I see you guys every year or so, and I'm interested. Do we have anything? I sound like I know something, but help me here.
Thank you, Regent Boylan. This is E.J. Okbeche, Cambridge Associates, for the record.
Outstanding.
We do have exposure in our sustainability focus or lens on this portfolio does allow for that regional exposure. I think there was a, I'll actually hand this to my colleague, Wendy, because I want to get specific on this, and I need to pull that detail for you, but let me hand it.
Sure. So we do have an investment that had been approved a few years ago into Access Community Investment Fund. This is a mortgage-backed securities strategy that invests solely in government-backed issuance, and the operating fund has a $23.5 million investment in that fund as of August 31st. And these assets, the fund allows investors to earmark their assets. So NSHE's assets are exclusively in the state of Nevada and targeted towards low to mid-income communities in the state of Nevada. So it's mortgages in low to moderate income communities. But the great thing about this is that these are backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. So they are not taking on mortgage borrower risk in any geography. We are funding home purchasers or apartment building owners in the state. But our investment is backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government.
Thank you. Now, I'll come back to the same thing again. I know nothing about this. I'll say it up front. But I still didn't share anything that we are investing in something from Nevada. investing in real estate is a risky business, and I don't care if it's backed by the federal government. I'm asking about Nevada. Or did I miss something? Both of you, I didn't get any answer.
Sorry, I should have been more clear.
No
so
worries.
These are mortgages that are made to homeowners and apartment yeah. owners in the state of Nevada. So we have mortgage-backed securities that are solely located in the state of Nevada. And as a follow-up item, we could even share some details about which specific communities. This manager produces some great collateral on an annual basis showing the local impact. So we'd be happy to send that along. But it's a $23.5 million of mortgage-backed securities. So local banks had given mortgages to either individual homeowners or apartment building owners, and then they securitized these mortgages and sold these mortgages to this manager. So now Enchi, as a participant in this fund, owns these mortgages and has basically infused these dollars back into the community banks. The community banks get the loans off their books so they can yes. lend to other borrowers in Nevada. And then we hold the $23.5 million of mortgage-backed securities located in the state of Nevada.
Okay, I got that. I'm a simple man, but I get it. But you still, I don't think you got. My question is, do we invest in gaming? Maybe I'll just make it right up front. Gambling. Not playing games with kids, that's fun, but do we? I'm just curious. It's good money. It's a good investment. And I'm sure you can ask all the regions, the young man found something outstanding.
Thank you. I was looking at the private investment portfolio, but my colleague Wendy was looking at the public investment. And so I will highlight one opportunity or investment in a manager, HGVora, that has a gaming that has gaming investments. I was unsure if we were able to divulge that information, but
no, we're not. Okay, I didn't hear it, but so we do invest in that. That's awesome. That's interesting. Thank you so much. Thank you, Chair, and young man, would you say your name again? Because even I couldn't pronounce it. Say it.
For the record, it's EJ Ogbeche. Cambridge Associates.
EJ Ogbeche. Did I get it right now?
EJ Ogbeche.
EJ Ogbeche. Thank you so much. Thank you, Chair. Appreciate it.
Thank you, CFO Vitone.
Thanks, Chair Chris Vitone. I just wanted to offer a couple extra comments also on this that they, in terms of to address Regent Boylan's question. I think that question may be more applicable to the endowment pool where there's more discretion to invest in specific or individual entities versus the operating pool where the investment direction is really driven toward index publicly traded funds. And so certainly within those indexed funds, there would be organizations that are in Nevada, but the fund is not investing directly into individual institutions versus the endowment pool where there is discretion, and particularly the private equity, the alternative investment segment of the fund, where there's more discretion there, and that's where Cambridge has a very robust process to evaluate opportunities, and certainly Nevada companies would be eligible for that consideration there.
Thank you, Mr. Vitton. Thank you so much.
So are there any other questions from members of the committee or regents off the committee? I'd like to also extend out to Mr. Densler if you have any questions or comments. No. So I believe this is addressing if we want to make a change in the distribution rate, but as I understand, there was no recommended change made. So do we need an action on this then? Is there any motion to be made by anyone?
Make
Mr. a motion. Yes, Regent Carvalho.
Thank you. I will move to maintain the operating fund distribution rate at 2.75%.
Thank you. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a motion from Regent Carvalho, a second from mm-hmm. Vice Chair Arascata. And any further discussion on this matter? Seeing none, I'll call for the vote. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. No abstentions, so the motion passes. Thank you. Okay, we'll go on to item number 7, endowment pool performance from Cambridge Associates. This is an information item.
Thank you, EJ Ogbeche, Cambridge Associates, for the record. I'll start on slide 9 of 41 in item 7. And we've touched on much of this already, so I'll be brief in my comments here. What you'll see towards the middle of the page, the top line for total endowment, fiscal year to date, so fiscal year 2025, preliminary performance at 10.3%. Mr. Densler let us know that that was acceptable from a absolute return perspective, despite the underperformance to the benchmark during that period. We also saw slight underperformance during a shorter period, calendar year to date. So you'll see that 5.9% versus the 6.3% from the benchmark. That was followed by a strong July of almost 1% return, and an even stronger August with about 1.7% or nearly 2% return. So roughly about 8.5% is where the total endowment sits at the end of August. For the longer term, since the 8 years and one quarter that you'll see here for the annualized since that first quarter of 2017, you'll see that 8.2% return, 20 basis points per year ahead of the policy benchmark. And if you were to backtrack that one quarter to include all private investments, that would actually be 30 basis points ahead of the benchmark per year. I'll jump quickly to the next slide, and we touched on this at the outset. So the next slide, slide 10, we touched on the outperformance over time, but what you're seeing here is rolling annualized performance. And we wanted to call out, 2022 was a tough environment in the market sell-off. We saw an unusual public equities public equities and fixed income have an unusually high correlation during that year. So both asset classes were down substantially. And wanted to point out, in that time since then, since that bottom, while we've seen, the policy benchmark have a greater return, I wanted to call out that this was actually from a lower starting point. So, albeit a stronger return since that sell-off, I just wanted to call out that the total endowment did maintain its outperformance, and it increased its outperformance, its value add during that down market. And that's really critical, and that's how we like to think about our portfolios, that it protects on the downside even better than it would in an up market. And so what you see on the bottom half of that page that we shared in the OCIO update up front, which is how much stronger the portfolio got, during that downturn. And so you see that gap widening a bit during that period. But ultimately, again, we're at a point where we're ahead of the policy benchmark and adding value in the portfolio. And that's something I think we're extremely proud of. On the next slide, I would quickly, point out that, yes, you can have better returns, but if that comes at the expense of more risk, then you're not getting better risk-adjusted returns, and you're increasing the risk or the danger of the portfolio. So I'm pleased to see here that the total endowment at 7.7% had just 11.6% in standard deviation or the volatility of the portfolio. So that yielded a stronger Sharpe ratio at 0.47 than the policy benchmark that you see here, strictly because it had lower volatility while maintaining strong risk-adjusted returns. And this is over the full OCIO track record. Very briefly on slide 12. Again, when you look at the full 8-year track record to include PI lagged to the first quarter of 2025, you'll see in that box at the center of the page, just where the value add has come from. That's really been driven by our private growth or our private equity and our venture capital allocation, and I'll speak to that a bit more in detail in subsequent slides. as well as you know, public marketable equities that added value over that period as well. I guess I'll quickly say on the right-hand side, you'll see that 8.2% versus of the portfolio versus the policy at 7.6% on the left-hand side. And that's, again, that difference is annualized over those 8 years. Let's jump to the next slide because, you know, while we have, you know, enjoyed that outperformance over the longer term, we have seen some challenges in the near term. And that's, you know, we've seen that in our private investment portfolio, most acutely in our private growth venture capital allocation. But you'll see here as well, you know, our private real assets, you know, were challenged over this period. But again, thinking longer term, you know, we're still very confident that private investments will add value to the portfolio over a full market cycle. So just a year of underperformance is not an area for us to drive a tremendous amount of concern. And the next slide, you know, I touched on this again at the beginning of our time here, but again, just emphasizing the strong performance that we saw in 2020, 2021, and 2022. You know, it really helped get a lead, so that you know, even despite the underperformance in 23 and 24, we're still at a strong position, you know, over the longer term. Adding value from a private investment portfolio perspective, and we're starting to see you know, private investments really start to drive out performance again. We saw a brief moment of that in Q1, and you know, hopefully that's the canary in the coal mine for future periods where we can see that outperformance start to come through again. And the next slide, slide 15, I'll just quickly you know, show. In the striped bars, you'll see on the far right, again, the meaningful outperformance that ENSHI has experienced from both its private equity in blue and its venture capital in green versus the benchmark in gray. And that's over a longer period, the longer five-year period. While, again, we've seen these challenges over the near term that venture has explicitly seen, and you'll see that here. Although, again, the ENSHI portfolio has outperformed, the venture capital allocation outperformed, it's still challenged in terms of performance over 3 years, and then even 1 year, more challenged from a venture perspective. But we have seen private equity add value. And so slide 16 is an interesting analysis we did looking at periods where we've seen this dislocation in markets, from public markets as defined by ACWI, global public markets, versus the private growth allocation that you have defined by that PE, VC, private equity, and venture capital allocation. When on the left-hand side, you'll see that delta, the biggest years that we've seen of underperformance in private investments, you've just experienced a couple of those. In 2023 and 2024, we've seen some of the greatest challenged markets when you're comparing private investments to public equities. But what we're encouraged by is on the right-hand side, over each of the periods that we've observed where that underperformance exists, the subsequent 3 years, we've seen outperformance. And over these periods thus far, that's averaged over 8.5%. Of performance over those 3 years, of outperformance over those 3 years. So we're encouraged looking forward that 2023 and 2024 will yield similar results. And then the next few pages really are more of a leave behind, but really our helping understand the benchmarks that we use. Over the shorter term period, our policy benchmark, the intermediate period, where we have the simple benchmark, stocks and bonds, then over the much longer period where we're trying to beat inflation, we show each of those benchmarks over the subsequent three pages after page 17. So I won't go into the detail there, but again, for your benefit as a leave behind. I will jump ahead to page 22 and 23 briefly, just to say that We are within the policy, the allowable ranges in terms of the policy on page 22. And in 2023, we are in compliance with liquidity guidelines. Page 24 and 25, I won't speak to. It's really a brief snapshot of the alternate, the marketable alternative portfolio and the private investment portfolio. So feel free to, again, view those at the total asset class level. But I'll pause on page 27 just to, again, call out the strong performance that we've seen from private investments, the managed portfolio that we have. So not the legacy portfolio that we inherited, but really the managed portfolio. Driving over 8% of value add each year since inception. So I will pause there before if there are any other comments or questions.
Are there any questions from members of the committee?
Question.
Vice Chair Escada.
Bear with me on this. I'm not quite sure how I'm going to present this. If you go back to page 16, it's where we identified the PI returns have rebounded after materially lagging public equity returns.
Would there be a greater rate of investment? As you stated, over the subsequent years, you see a better rebound, a greater rebound. Would there be a targeted investment strategy to focus on the higher return of those subsequent years? Is that question? I hope I'm presenting it
correctly. I think I understand the question. EJ Ogbeche, again, for the record, Cambridge Associates. If I'm understanding the question, are there certain asset classes that we would think about leaning into to help make sure that we experience this outperformance in subsequent years? Is that?
Thank you for the translation.
Okay. Yes. And I think, specifically, venture capital and private equity, in the sense that those are the two growth equity, private equity, venture capital. Those are the asset classes that have yielded the strongest return over time. But also, although it has a large dispersion, we're confident with our process, with our team and our research team, that we'll lean into the top quartiles of those asset classes. So it really is just leaning into the higher performing asset class, private investment asset classes, but then also having exposure to some consistent returns in the portfolio. And that's something we see not specifically in the private equity and venture asset allocation of the portfolio, but in our private diversifiers, where we have credit and lending strategies that are able to provide a consistent yield and return to the portfolio. And so I'll feel free to add anything.
Yeah, because optimistically, as what y'all have stated, the subsequent three-year annual returns, those are some very optimistic numbers.
Well, that's the lived experience for each of those periods. So
okay,
that's just reflecting the data.
One final comment is that the timing of the unwinding of the Russell mandate and new assets flowing into the Cambridge mandate has actually ended up being, I think, quite fortuitous for NSHI, because what it meant is that we've been deploying, we got a large influx into our mandate. It went into public markets, and now we ended up underweight our targets to private equity and venture capital, which takes a while to deploy, but it means that we are deploying in this 2022, 2023, 2024 environment, where pricing for private equity and particularly venture capital, like EJ said, is much more rational today than it was back in 2020 and 2021. So we are buying near at more of a trough pricing environment for these private markets, and we're still underweight. So we've been, in this period, we've been accelerating our commitments to these areas. We're still aiming for vintage year diversification. We're not piling in all at once, but it means that we're deploying new, fresh dollars in a much more rational valuation environment.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Are there any other questions from members of the committee? Are there any questions from regents who are not on the committee? Mr. Dinsler, any questions? Okay. Okay. So are you going to continue or?
No further comment. Thank you. No further comments on this section, and happy to take any other questions or move on to the next section.
That seems like there are no other questions, so we'll move on to item 8, which is an action item, endowment pool distribution rate and policy.
I guess let me introduce. I'm sorry, Chris Vitone just introduced the item. This is similar to the discussion you had two items ago on the operating distribution rate. This is a committee discussion annually to revisit the endowment spending rate, and Cambridge will present here as well.
Thank you, E.J. Ogbeche, Cambridge Associates, for the record. So I'll start on in item 8A, start on page 3 of 5. So what we share here, just a quick overview, we're sharing spending. It's a review of the spending policy, but we're doing it in, we're sharing that in the context of peers as well. So it, you just have a good sense of where your policy is versus, again, peers. So why is this, why are we looking at this today? So you're looking at what you see boxed in that on the right-hand side of the page. You'll see that the 4.625% spending rate is right in line with peers. And so you'll see that similarly sized peers between $200 and $500 million, have about 60% of their, just over 60% of respondents have a spending rate between 4.5% and 5%. And so similarly, colleges and universities, again, just over 60% with that spending between 4.5% and 5%. So, you know, comfortably within that range at 4.625 for the endowment. The next slide just gives context around how spending rules might have changed over recent years. So we look at the past 5 years, and what we can observe is that more than 70% of the respondents chose to maintain their level of spending. And while there were changes in the balance of the remaining 28%, we found more that decrease their spending rate than those that increase their spending rate. So just trying to give you a better sense of trends over this period. And then I'll finish on page 5 of 5, really just to look at the an illustrative view at what spending rates, what different spending rates might have meant for asset values and the spending, the annual spending. So when you see at the very top of the page, you'll see sort of intuitively this. I'll take a step back. Sorry, this data is looking at it's an illustrative view since 1930. What spending would have been, what the market values would have been of the portfolio had spending been at each of the rates shown at the top, 4.5%. 4.625, the actual spending, and 4.75 shows what those market values would have been over time. And intuitively, if you were spending more, the actual market value of the portfolio would be lower. So you see the orange line with the highest spending rate at 4.75 is just at 437, below where we would be today at the 4.625 spending rate. And then what does that mean in terms of the dollars deployed each year? In the middle chart, you'll see that, again, if at the higher spending rate, you would have had, you would have been able to deploy $22 million, annually or this year, as opposed to the $25 at $25 million at the current spending rate. So just giving you the sense to illustratively share, a higher spending rate means lower market values and lower spending values. I'll pause there.
Okay. Are there any questions from the committee? any questions from members, any regents who are not on the committee? Okay, Mr. Densler.
For the record, Mark Densler, UNR Foundation, just because I know Regent Ariscotti, you're going to ask me, UNR's distribution rate is currently pegged at 4.5% and has been for a significant period of time. It is not currently being reviewed this year.
Okay, why don't you proceed, please?
So those are all the comments okay. that I have for that section.
Chris Vitone, for the record, if I may, I just to clarify, I think the recommendation is to not change, not for no change in the distribution rate.
Okay, I think I don't know if you're going to go on to the INV 8B document or not for that. But so if you're finished, any other questions from the committee, or is there a motion? I'll entertain a motion.
I'll move to maintain the endowment pool distribution rate of 4.5%.
And I'll second.
Is it 4.65 or is it? Okay. Okay. We have a motion and a second. Is there any other discussion? Seeing none, call for the vote. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. No abstentions. The motion passes. Okay. Thank you. Now we're on to new business. Are there any suggested items of new business for consideration at a future meeting?
Chair Downs?
Yes.
It's not necessarily a new business item. It's just a request from the UNLV Foundation for a representative. We're having a lot of discussions in regards to the foundation, both foundations of UNR and UNLV, and respectfully requesting their presence at a future meeting.
Thank you. Any other new business items people members would like to bring forward? I would like to explore, I know we only meet twice a year, but if this committee should, the components of this committee or the functions of the committee should be rolled into the BFF committee. Is that something, and I say this knowing that we have coming down the road fewer regents are going to be on the board, and so just to not have so many committees out there. So would it be reasonable or appropriate to have this committee be put under BFF? So something to explore. So if there's nothing else, I guess we'll go on to public comment. Is there any public comment at GBC?
There is none at this time.
Is there any public comment at the system office in Las Vegas?
None at this time.
Thank you. Is there any public comment here in Reno? Do not see any. SCS, is there any public comment on the phone?
No callers at this time, Mr. Chair.
Okay, then I will at 11:37 adjourn the meeting. Thank you, everyone.